The development of socialism and the 1848 revolution. Our progress in history has taken us to the middle of the 19th century. Vast changes in social development have taken place. New class relationships have sprung up, resulting from changes in the economy. Two new classes confront each other, the capitalist class and the working class. History now becomes a struggle between these two classes. Thought has also changed as ideas of socialism begin to arise. We must pause here to examine some of this thought, although only in bare outline, for this subject will be dealt with in our philosophy course, where it will be seen that socialism could only be brought to light in this period of the developing forces of production. Characteristics of utopian socialists. That thought is restricted to the developing forms of production and the social structure built up from it is illustrated clearly in the beliefs of the utopian socialism. To them, capitalism progressed history to the stage of the abolition of man's tyranny over man in abolishing slavery and serfdom. Capitalism, therefore, was absolute. The existing horrors within it of exploitation could be eradicated through reforms. In other words, truth was absolute and morality permanent. Things and their mental images, ideas, are isolated and considered apart from each other. This led them to the belief that men could arise who, through appeal to the better nature of man, could force a change for the betterment of society. Robert Owen, for example, appealed to Queen Victoria and the Archbishop of Canterbury to intervene against the frightful conditions of poverty existing amongst the working class, as well as the inhuman exploitation. Needless to say, this appeal fell on deaf ears. In philosophy, the utopians were characterized as idealists, that is, that ideas within many are primary and that the material world is secondary, that man's ideas of what is good could ultimately change the world. Scientific socialism. Marx and Engels were the first to discard the ideas of the utopists and to lift the thought on socialism to a scientific category. This they did through a study of philosophy. The history and economic writings of Marx and Engels are permeated with philosophical ideas. The philosophy in this case was derived from the dialectical method of reason of the idealist philosophy Hegel. Marx changed the method to a materialist form, which he expressed in dialectical materialism. Unlike the stationary ideas and beliefs of the utopians, the dialectic viewed everything in motion and continual change and development. Where the utopians said a thing exists or does not, it is good or bad, it is right or wrong, the dialectical method stated that these absolute statements cannot be made about anything. All things change. What apparently exists in absolute form is changing every moment of its existence. What today is true can tomorrow be false. What today is good can turn to its opposite, and at some stage of its existence be bad. The dialectic reasoning takes the following form. One idea gives birth to its opposite, which arises out of it through a contradiction of it. From the conflict of the two arises an amalgamation, a synthesis, a new idea. The first proposition is termed the thesis, its contradiction the antithesis, the second and third the synthesis, or in other words, the positive, the negative, and the negation of the negation. For example, a grain of wheat in the soil disappears. In its place arises a plant, which is a negation of the seed. Yet the life of the grain still lives in the plant. The plant grows and produces an ear characterizing and containing many ears of wheat. As soon as these grains ripen, the plant dies. It is negated in its turn, but in its place are many grains of wheat. The life that was in the grain and passed into the plant is now in many grains. The grain was and was not now exists in an increased quantity. With the human being, the boy is negated by the youth, which is in turn negated by the man. It is the same life and body. Changes within the human structure, which at intervals make leaps to something new, different, and yet the same life. In sociology, the dialectic points to the destruction of the old by the new force developing within it. From the period of primitive communism, every society had produced the seeds of its own destruction. Thus, feudalism, thesis, cannot exist without its antithesis, serf. Out of the conflict develops synthesis, the leap to something new, capitalism. From the conflict, man is faced with the leap to socialism. Thus, while there is recognition of the term evolution, it was the dialectic philosophy which first explained leaps or revolutions to the new. In outline, we have explained the thought which arose with the development of capitalist society. The utopians with their final truths, their conceptions of right or wrong, fairness and justice. With the Marxists, the dialectic, the science of the universal law of motion and evolution in nature, science and thought. It's essential for students to grasp something of these thoughts, for they dominate social history today. The dialectic, which was very popular in the early stages of the 19th century, was very soon discarded with the revolutionary history of the working class in 1848. Marxist thought had great influence in Europe from the middle of last century and went on to the 1917 revolution in Russia. However, after the 30s of the 19th century, the murderous attack on the Marxists, who led the Russian Revolution, by its own self-styled adherents, developed a void in dialectical thought, which lost many advantages to the workers in situations developing ripely for socialism. Today, reformism, the line of the utopian socialists, is very much in evidence. With the absence of a dialectical analysis of events, the leadership of the labour movement thinks of everlasting existence of things. It replaces the struggle with the permanency of capital society, any disturbance of which can be solved in a capitalist way. Out of Marxist philosophy comes this materialist conception of history, the theory that history is not determined by the wishes and desires of men, but by the productive forces, the way in which things are produced, and the superstructure proceeding from this. It is also brilliantly illustrated in the Communist Manifesto, published by Marx and Engels on the eve of the 1848 revolution in France. The 1848 revolution in France. The great French Revolution of 1789 to 1794 failed to complete the bourgeois democratic revolution. After Robespierre's fall, which was called Thermidor, the radical measures of the petty bourgeois Jacobins began to be annulled. The forces of the petty bourgeois and the workers who fought with them were exhausted. The peasants, having gained its class interests, were no longer interested in continuing the struggle. The big bourgeoisie, finance and industrial, were more interested in squabbles over their conflicting interests, and they were unable to seize the power. Finally, General Napoleon Bonaparte, through the agency of military force, dispersed the Jacobin Directory, replacing it with a consulate in 1799, in which he declared himself first consul and later made himself emperor in 1804. Students should interest themselves in this event. In Marxist analysis, it is termed Bonapartism, and it has occurred over and over again in history. It's a situation in which neither force in society is in sufficient strength to seize the power. Power in these circumstances falls to the military with full agreement of the bourgeoisie, who accept a position that forces them also from power, in the belief that once order is restored by the army and the class struggle subdued, they, the bourgeoisie, will be restored to power. This was the position after the French Revolution, and it also becomes the position, Bonapartism, after the 1848 events in France. Referred to as the First Empire, Napoleon's restoration of order enabled the bourgeoisie to determine the policy of the government. The peasantry were quietened by maintaining most of the gains won in the revolution. However, the defeat of Napoleon by the feudal coalition in Europe resulted in a restoration of the old Bourbon monarchy, destroyed by the revolution. The nobles who had fled France returned and endeavoured to win back their old privileges. They received millions in compensation for their loss of property. The conflict between the industrial and the financial bourgeoisie grew to further intensity with the return of the Bourbons, and in July 1830 it resulted in a new outbreak in which the Bourbon monarchy was replaced by a monarchy of the Orleans dynasty, Louis-Philippe, a monarch representation of the financial bourgeoisie. Henceforth, the bankers will rule in France, declared the banker Lafitte. The reason for the success of this section of the bourgeoisie, rather than to the industrialists, can be seen by contrasting French society with Britain. In England, the Industrial Revolution had transformed the entire national economy, while France was still predominantly an agricultural country. In Britain, the peasants were only 23% of the population. In France, they were 75%. After the Great Revolution in France, small holdings became the chief form of land tenure. The peasantry, burdened by taxes, could not advance far on their own resources. They were compelled to contract debts or rent more land to try and improve its cultivation. In either case, they were compelled to resort to loans, that is, to mortgage on their land. Thus, every year, the peasant paid interest on his loans and repaid part of the original sum borrowed. By 1840, these payments amounted to 550 million francs a year, about one-third of the net income of the French peasantry. The peasant was driven to mortgage more and more land, and the money lenders made greater and greater profits. The usurer ruled in the village, while over the whole of France, the banker financed capital ruled. Another source of income for the bankers was the state budget deficit. These increased over the years as a result of prolonged wars and the numerous officials and officers required in a country of small peasants. The way of meeting these deficits was by loans, which the financiers granted at very high interest rates. The industrial bourgeoisie were not the dominant factor because industrial development in France, although on the upgrade, was far from that of the industrial growth in Britain. In 1839, the number of steam engines in France, 2,540, increased to 4,583 by 1847. Coal production in the same period reached from 18,000 tons to over 5 million tons. However, there was considerable opposition to large-scale industry from the petty bourgeoisie. The working class grew in numbers as a result of industrial development, but the large majority were employed in small concerns and many worked in their homes. The idea of becoming independent businessmen still possessed a large section of the workers, and with small masters they opposed large-scale industry. Here then is the historical materialist analysis of France on the eve of the 1848 revolution. Not only does this analysis throughout the productive forces explain the different groupings in French society, but their strivings as well as the form that their class struggle would take. The social conditions were aggravated by political manoeuvrings. Of the French population of 24 million, only 240,000, the richest bourgeoisie and landowners, were entitled to vote. The financial bourgeoisie, with their corrupt methods of enriching themselves, gave rise to general dissatisfaction. The industrial bourgeoisie were opposed to the regime, not in opposition to the monarchy, but because of the limited franchise, which denied them a place. Events came to a head with the economic crisis of 1848. A comparison with the former year gives some impression of its character. Imports to France in 1847 were 1,290 million francs. These fell to 708 million in 1848. Industrial production in France over the same period fell from 1,463 million francs to 677 million. Figures for unemployment rose considerably. Some 186,000 workers were dismissed. The conflict, which began as a struggle to reform the franchise, developed into revolution, and on February the 24th, 1848, Louis-Philippe was overthrown. What was the character of the February Revolution? The purpose of the February Revolution was to complete the bourgeois revolution, replace the monarchy with the republic, extend political power to the industrial bourgeoisie, and aid the transformation of Europe from a feudal to a capitalist economy. However, the bourgeoisie confined their opposition to Parliament. It was the working class that made the February Revolution. In 1830, the workers played a decisive part in destroying the Bourbon monarchy, but inexperience had prevented them from the proclamation of a republic. By 1848, the workers had not only increased numerically, but in experience, and it was determined to make use of its victory. From Paris, the workers marched on the provisional government with their demand for a republic. With this demand conceded to, they then raised their own class demands, the abolition of unemployment, and the formation of a Ministry of Labour to enforce it. They compelled the provisional government to include representatives from the petty bourgeois. Les Deux Rouen and Louis Blanc, as well as a direct class representative, Albert. Recording this episode, Karl Marx in his work, The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, wrote, "The proletariat having won it, the Republic, by force of arms, put the stamp of its class upon the new creation, and proclaimed the Socialist Republic. Thus was indicated the general significance of modern revolution, a significance which was, however, in this case, sharply contrasted with all that was immediately practicable in view of the materials to hand." End of quote. Marx's references to "all that was immediately practicable in view of the materials to hand" refers that the industrial capitalism had not yet gained its historic position. Capitalism and its negative factor, the proletariat, had to develop further before the conditions ripened for the socialist challenge. However, the independent action of the workers changed the relationship of class forces in France. The independent action of the working class helped to cement unity amongst the bourgeoisie, financiers and industrialists, an important factor of note because this tactic is always repeated once the dominant class finds its position challenged. As soon as there is independent class action by the workers, disagreement amongst the upper sections of the bourgeoisie is eliminated, and the move is made for unity of all against the workers. Louis Blanc and Blanqui. As we've already indicated, Blanqui ignored organisational questions in favour of a direct onslaught. Even though in a minority, he succeeded in whipping up support for mass demonstrations against the provisional government. This action forced the government to postpone the elections to the National Assembly, with a view of creating calm in which to put their propaganda to the populace. They also forced on the government the formation of a compromise position in which representatives of the government met representatives of the worker in order to settle their problems peacefully. Blanqui opposed this compromise, now known as the Luxembourg Commission, which urged the workers to the overthrow of the government forces. Louis Blanc, however, urged confidence in the petty bourgeois and workers' representatives to make the Luxembourg Commission work in favour of the workers. Louis Blanc, who was made chairman of the commission, had his point of view endorsed by the workers. The postponement of the election was, as indicated by Blanqui, valueless to the workers' cause. Their leaders wasted time in endless discussions, while the bourgeoisie were busy welding the united front in preparation for a frontal attack. They satisfied the interests of the financiers by paying the interest on state bonds before the date they were due. On the other hand, saving banks were restrained from paying out larger sums than 100 francs, and direct taxation, which fell mainly on the peasantry, was increased by 45%. So the peasantry were forced into opposition to the Republic. In March 1848, national workshops were set up as part of the plan to relieve unemployment. The work done was non-productive in character, and it soon became obvious that unemployment, which was responsible for 100,000 employed in the national workshops by May, was being used for the purpose of discrediting the social measure in the eyes of the public, thus isolating the working class still further. The government allowed such propaganda slogans to be used throughout France, such as, quote, 100,000 idlers living at France's expense. So when the elections to the National Assembly were held in April the 23rd, it was easy to forecast the result. A great majority for the bourgeoisie against the revolutionary republic. The workers of Paris replied to the result of demonstrations against the National Assembly, amongst their demands being support for the revolutionary movements in Europe, mainly in Germany and Austria, which had become influenced by the class struggles in France. The government concentrated troops around Paris. On July the 21st, they suspended the national workshops. The workers replied to this with a call to arms. And for 4 days, from June the 23rd to the 26th, they fought the government forces at the barricades. Finally, the Army of the National Guard under General Cavaignac succeeded in suppressing the insurrection with great slaughter. Bonapartism. After the June insurrection, the bourgeoisie sought to consolidate their position in the presidential election of December 1848. But their nominee, General Cavaignac, was easily defeated by Louis Bonaparte, nephew of the first emperor. The elections reveal how, with the crushing of the workers, the old disagreements amongst the bourgeoisie were again to the fore. The December election saw the struggle between the peasantry against the working class, whom they feared would, if successful, confiscate the land. At the same time, it showed dissatisfaction with the exploiters of the peasantry, the financial bourgeoisie. The first Napoleon was extremely popular with the peasants. They considered his victory over feudal Europe had gained them and enabled them to retain the land won from the Great Revolution. The mantle of glory thus descended upon the nephew. The presidential elections also saw diverse elements between the small holders of land and the big bourgeoisie. The petty bourgeoisie were looking for unity with the working class. To prevent their displacement by the growing discontent, the bourgeoisie limited the franchise. By 1850, power was slipping from them to such a degree that the instability was interfering with business. It is in this situation, a position in which the bourgeoisie feel the power slipping from their grasp, and no single party in sufficient development to seize the power, that the bourgeoisie look to the suspension of democracy and the reliance upon the military to take control and restore order for their return. This is again a reference to Bonapartism, a situation already referred to and repeated again and again in the history as a prop to the capitalist regime. In this circumstance, the bourgeoisie withdraw support to their parliamentary representatives, who were fighting against the attempts of Bonaparte to restore the empire and himself as dictator. Karl Marx, in his work The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, brilliantly and analyzes this situation of Bonapartism. Quote, "It's, the bourgeoisie's, attitudes show that the fight to maintain its public interest, its class interest, and its political power was regarded by it as undesirable, and nothing more than the disturbance of the tranquil course of private business. The aim of the bourgeoisie was to establish a strong government, one with unlimited powers, one whose protection businessmen could concentrate their attention upon private business affairs. Thus the bourgeoisie declared unanimously its eagerness for abdication. The bourgeois class, together with other classes, had to be condemned to political nullity in order that the bourgeois money bags might be saved. The bourgeoisie must be sacrificed to the crown." End of quote. In this way, Bonaparte won an easy victory. On December 1855, he dissolved the National Assembly, and a year later had himself proclaimed Emperor Napoleon III. "The bourgeoisie bowed to the sword," stormed Marx. The period commencing with 1848 is extremely important for Labour students of history. The materialist conception of history brilliantly scores in the analysis of Marx in his The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte and Class Struggles in France. The counter-revolutionary attitude of the bourgeoisie once their power is challenged, the relation of forces to prevent a Bonapartist situation, the tactical measures to adopt in methods of compromise, as in the case of the Luxembourg Commission, are all problems which have been misused by the labour movement through failure to grasp what attitude to adopt. Thus, ignorance has played a large part in the defeats suffered by the workers on historic occasions of the class struggle, where independent action could well have changed the course of history.